Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Chang Ray Lee. He's the author of A Gesture Life, published by Riverhead Books, the author as well of Native Speaker, which won most of the literary prizes for its year for first novel. His books are literary books. They center around the lives of Korean-Japanese Americans. And they are very unusual books in that while poetic and intimate, they are interested in describing what is sometimes called in Native Speaker the Chinese wall between the speaker and other people. And I wondered, how do you make language that can describe people who are trying to conceal themselves?
I think it's always a language of great restraint, but it's restraint for me that is born from a strange kind of, I would say, ecstatic energy too, because where there's restraint and silence, there's always, I think, deep emotion. One of the pieces that has spoken to me as a writer, a piece of literature, is many parts of Leaves of Grass. And in that book, there's this ecstatic, broad, expansive reaching. Not quiet at all, of course, not silent at all. But there was something emotionally there that I thought, that's exactly the feeling that some of these people that I'm writing about, that's exactly the feeling and maybe the exact tonality that I want to get to, that I think is the undercurrent of what's happening.
That's very interesting. Leaves of Grass, Whitman provides the epigraph to your first novel, and it is a kind of, while many people talk about the exuberance of Whitman, they don't talk about the uncertainty of boundarylessness, of exploring a completely unbounded self. But your people are almost unusually bound. Is it the hypothetical possibility of disclosure that you're talking about as their ecstasy?
Yeah, it's the anticipation of it, or the hope or aspiration of it, which is always there. I always felt that from, you know, not a literary figure, obviously, but just my parents, who were not comfortable in the language being English. But I always felt that they had so much, and when they wanted to speak a sentence in English that was important, that actually meant something, that was there to connect, you could see all this frustration and energy welling up. Had they had the language and the syntax and whatever, you know, they'd absolutely sing. So it's the disparity between that wanting to sing and knowing that you can, but not having just the building blocks of that.
It's fascinating because the hero of the new book, Franklin Hatta, is a man living outside New York in a town that you've invented named, is it Bedley Run?
Right.
I had the problem, I kept thinking of Bedford Falls.
Yeah.
The town in It's a Wonderful Life. And he has identified with a story that he's read in one of his adoptive daughter's textbooks, the story The Swimmer by John Cheever, about a man severely alienated, who imagines an escape to freedom by swimming through all of the pools of his neighborhood as if they led eventually to an ocean. And it's such an interesting conjunction. A shut down Korean man and the urbane John Cheever.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of delightful, actually, that he would, that in, at least in my imagination, Franklin Hutter would come across this book. I thought it was a perfect moment on a lot of levels. I thought that he was, of course, just on the surface level, experiencing a version of himself in this landscape, just the physical landscape. But I also, obviously, I mean, Cheever looms large over everything that happens in suburbia, and mostly, of course, over its imagination. And I thought that here was this man Hata, and how he could situate himself in that imagination, begin to at least, just take himself out of the everyday, but begin to think of himself as part of a more ethereal landscape, I suppose, a landscape of possibility.
And it's fascinating because, you know, most of Cheever's heroes, at least, are disillusioned, and their moments of revelation involve the discovery of loss. And Hata kind of aspires to be a Cheever hero in a peculiar way.
He's not disillusioned in because he enters the picture. He enters the scene at a very different place than Cheever's heroes do. He's much further past it, I think. And that's not a compliment to him or to me. It's just he's an older man who is still aspiring to a certain kind of belonging that the Cheever heroes have already rejected.
Now, the shape of that aspiration is delimited, in a sense, in this book by the elements of fire and water. They seem to be the poles of pleasure and destruction for him, and they play throughout the book in a poetic and very conscious manner. And I wondered if you could speak about that structuring.
Well, I kept thinking about, when I thought about Hata, I thought about not just the accoutrement of his life, but how I could move him, how I could shake him. And that led me to an idea or just a vision of him in certain elements. And it's a very classical way to think about a character, of course, but I saw him at the center. Usually there are four elements, of course. there's wind also. I forget the fourth one.
Earth,
right.
And he is a tiller of soil.
Yeah,
in
he
the
is.
Garden.
But for me, there's just the qualities of fire and water, the submergence in the latter, of course, and his wanting to rise out of it, and then with fire, it's the thing that is, I think, burning in his heart and burning in his blood. He's got this terrible, terrible and very, I think, very excited possibility in him, which is to both recognize what his life has been about and understand that crucible of it. But the water, I think it's... It's a very interesting question you asked, actually.
Well, I thought about it because someone once told me that the ideogram in Chinese for the body is the burning house. And for someone who's always trying to put out fires, this 70-year-old man is always trying to mix the metaphor, cast oil on troubled waters, to calm things, to not allow a conflagration, that he spends so much time in water seems to be to put the burning house out, you know, to quench the fire.
Yeah, it's almost a way of his self-medicating, in a sort of way.
Returning to a meditative or a uterine state?
Yeah, that's completely, you know, it's an isolation tank of his own making. There's a reason that he swims every day, and it's not for exercise. It's to forget himself, but also to feel free. he talks about it as his only flying. It's his real liberty too. And it's those moments when, of course, just at that moment of liberty, you know, that's when you realize, no, I'm completely tethered. I'm completely stuck in this life.
I'm talking to Chang Rae Lee about his recent novel, A Gesture Life, from Riverhead Books. He thinks of the pool as his ocean, of the house as his empire of one, and it is a very isolate life. Although he has brought in a daughter, he almost immediately, we discover, feels uncomfortable with her, and then attempts lifelong to locate that discomfort outside himself.
It's a very frustrating relationship that they have, I think. It's one that I, as a writer, I think it's a case of writing something that you're afraid of,
mm-hmm.
And hoping that it won't come true for you. I was speaking to someone else about that, and how right from the beginning there's this distance from between the two. Initially from Hada and his surprise of who she is. She's not a pure Asian girl. But then, of course, it's built by her reaction to that, and then his reaction to that, and it's this, I think, very typical and very familial kind of escalation of non-feeling and of recrimination.
Well, this shut-off figure is often, in the two books, an occasion for shocked recognition. In Native Speaker, the wife, Lilia, sees a housemaid, a housekeeper, who has been with her husband's father for years and years, since her husband was a little boy.
And even has begun having a relationship with him.
Yes. And her husband doesn't know her name. And as she looks, this woman is a poet and is capable of recognizing the condition of the soul. She says she is an abandoned child grown up. And the sense here is of a world of abandoned children in their attempts to communicate or experiences.
And their striving to be part of something.
Yes.
Of course, it's never fulfilling and never enough. Ahata himself is in some sense an abandoned child. He's given up by his parents to a wealthy Japanese family, presumably for his own good. But what happens, of course, is in that, you know, in that leaving, there are great questions. You know, the great questions that I think all adopted children have about their origins, and of course. The unhappy moment of that decision.
I have a complicated kind of question. I noticed that in the first novel, Native Speaker, by my guest Chang Rae Lee, a psychoanalyst who is a mysteriously likable figure. In fact, the cut-off hero of this book, although he is seeing the psychoanalyst under false pretenses. He's a spy of sorts, and he's constructed a false life. The analyst immediately says to him that hand in hand with all that, parentage, intimacy, trust, is the larger issue of where we live and who you are within that place or believe yourself to be. We have our multiple roles like everyone else. Now throw in an additional dimension, a cultural one. Cast it all, if you will, in a broad yellow light. Let us see where this leads you and me. It's as if these statements are the seed of both of these novels. And I notice that your father is a psychoanalyst.
He's a psychiatrist, actually. He's much more pharmaceutical than talkie. But
nevertheless, the issue of fathers is very central in the advice that they have or don't have.
Yeah, there are a lot of father figures in native speaker. Or just fathers. Forget father figures. They're both very strong and very sure and also very wrong all the time. They're serially wrong. And that's something that I don't know. I won't say whether that's from my experience or not, poor father.
But in a gesture life as well, Hada owns a medical supply store. But he's known as Good Doc Hada, and there the doctor is the figure of the doctor is a kind of paternal figure as well.
He's a man of trust.
Yes.
Bestowed trust, which of course is particularly poignant for Hada because he feels as if inside he's been a fraud on certain levels throughout his life. But he needs that trust to believe in the daily activity of his life, the daily imagination that he has about who he is, which again is a fraud. He's someone that he's an odd figure because he's someone who's very frustrating. I think mm-hmm. He's absolutely a frustrating character.
And yet, you've made his frustration into the poetry of this book.
Well, I hope to make him. Just on the crassest level, just likable in a certain way. But the frustration is, of course, a metaphor for it's metaphorically expressed in everything that he does. The frustration the reader has with him. He's so stopped up. He's so distant, and yet, in his attempts to be very intimate, or at least to be very friendly, to belong, to be a good citizen. He turns that around as well.
To what extent does this need to be seen, as the doctor says in the previous book, in a yellow light?
Well, I was thinking about that. I think in the first book, everything is cast in a yellow light. And of course, that means a cultural one, one of self and society. And here it is too, but I really had hoped that this book and this character really was a particularity first.
Mm-hmm. Well, he definitely is.
And you know, and so much so that it almost doesn't matter who he is. But of course, everything that happens in his life hinges at some point or another on his position in society. Not that he's an Asian in America or an Asian somewhere else, but just that he's an outsider to a particular society, someone who wants in but doesn't really know why. So that's not a yellow light. It's a different kind of light.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a yellow shadow.
Yeah, but that was my hope, that in this book I could really think of him, and I did. I really thought of him as an older man who was absolutely himself but didn't have to be.
Mm. Now, many people talking about this book will inevitably talk about a circumstance in his past when he's been in Burma and helps a comfort woman as being a formative or a moment that both arrests and propels his subsequent behavior. But I would rather talk about a moment still more shocking and troubling. He eventually assists at the abortion of his adoptive daughter. In this, assuming once again a role he had in the army, that of doctor's assistant. And it is that position as doctor that has been the genesis of his trustworthiness and the trust that people place on him when they call him good Doc Hada. And yet this is a moment of terrible betrayal. And it's such a powerful and, you know, unthinkable moment. I wondered, knowing that you were going to write it, how did you prepare the narrative to accept a shock like that?
You know, I knew I was going to write it, but I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
All along and towards the end of the book, I didn't want to write it. I was dreading writing it because I was very afraid of it being just too much to handle for the book, for the character, for the narrative. And I think the only way that I had faith that I should write it and that maybe I could write it was that I had done enough work, or I'd hoped I had done enough work to show that it was an act that was possible for him, but possible not because he was a madman, not because he was cruel, but because he was so confused and so conflicted about what the right thing would be for a man in his attained position. It echoes, of course, an act that he went during the war. Kay, the comfort woman there, is brutally, savagely massacred by the soldiers, and he finds a fetus there. And I thought that would, in some ways, prepare the reader and the narrative for the possibility of such a thing happening. I mean, if you had told me that I would have to write a narrative about a man in his voice the entire book that would lead to such an act, I would have told you it was impossible. Mm-hmm. Impossible. Mm-hmm. To write that. No one would accept it. No one would want to read that. It would seem too monstrous. And I still don't quite know if it really works. I hope it works. But I guess on the more interesting level, not whether it works or not, is you know, what kinds of possibilities in him as a man of action and inaction made that possible? And I think it's both. It's not that he's a man of action. It's that he's a man of inaction, and that's what I've tried to show throughout the book. That's what drives people to actually do things. Mm-hmm. That's what drove Hada to do this horrible, horrible thing.
Now, the prose tone throughout is very measured and gradual, but quite poetic. And throughout I found it at its most beautiful when it was stillest, and it was stillest at moments of expressing sterility, fear, lonesomeness, passionlessness. And I wondered, you know, what is it that would take a young writer who, after all, I mean, I notice in Native Speaker, the opening chapters are more antic, in a sense, mm-hmm. than the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. There's an attempt to create a world in which characters are grabbing Yahtzee dice or cracking shells and strewing them around their desks as an early warning system. Here, we're dealing with a parched landscape. And I wondered about what would make a young writer turn toward not only age, but age at an extreme of additional lonelinesses.
Yeah, I think it was just a very personal need on my part, not so much in the writing, but just in my life at the time. There was a lot of things going on. My daughter was born, and we were moving into a different house. And I think somehow that imprinted upon my mode. And the mode was slow and steady control at all costs. And it you know, I became a pointillist in a way. I became a writer who wasn't expansive and exuberant, but you know, I think that's naturally how I was trained or born as some sort of writer. I mean, if Whitman trained me in some way because I loved his book so much, that's the kind of writer I think naturally I am. But it's a funny thing because I kept saying to my wife, this doesn't sound like me, but it feels like me. And maybe that's, I hope to think, maybe that's me developing as a writer, maybe maturing as a writer, accepting something that doesn't orally maybe sound like me, but maybe is me. I don't know that yet. I don't know what, you know, it leads me to another thought, which is I'm not quite sure what that voice of mine is anymore. In Native Speaker, given it was my first book, I thought I knew my voice.
Mm-hmm.
But after this book, I'm not so sure.
Well, it is, you know, it's sort of interesting because the voice is not just a throne voice, a ventriloquized mm-hmm. voice for you, but for Hadda, most of his articulations are in his mind.
Yeah.
And so it's almost as if he is spoken by his thoughts the way a puppet is spoken by a ventriloquist.
Yeah, well, he would never, of course, say those things explicitly.
He would never know, yes.
Right. Which was the additional challenge with him. I think it was because, partly also, I wrote him the way he did because of his character, because of what I thought he was. It was very limiting in a way. You know, if a writing teacher told you to write a character who didn't want to tell you about his life, who would do anything at all costs not to do so, how would you do that? How would you go about telling a story of a reluctant man and a reluctant speaker? A Native Speaker, he's reluctant in some ways, but he's very, very effusive also. And here, the effusiveness is completely a silent one. It's what's obviously roiling in his heart. So craft-wise, I felt like I was just pushing a pebble a millimeter at a time across the table.
I've been speaking to Chang Ray Lee. He is the author of A Gesture Life from Riverhead Books, the author previously of Native Speaker. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.